8:14 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, yesterday, the Park City Board of Education voted to move ahead with a two-bill schedule, costing an estimated $1 million more each year. The school board also ratified the contract for its classified staff and looked at the budget. In the studio with details, I have school board president Julie Eihausen, along with business administrator Todd Halber. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
So there was a review of the start time survey results, Julie, and the decision was made to implement the change with a target date of the 2018-19 school year. A lot in that survey, I know. The bottom line, though, is that the community appears to be pretty divided over the change. So the school board, given that we've got 60% wanting a change in start times, 40% saying, no, leave it as it is, and of that 60% evenly divided between the three options, the school board sounds like it's just going along with the 60% to try and make a change based on the research that we know that it helps adolescent and high school students?
Yeah, basically that is kind of the direction that we're going, because the science really supports that. And we did have, we've read several studies, but we had another study that was included in our board docs that basically said communities that have made this change, it's very frequent or it's very common for them to be 40 or 50% that don't really want to change. But then after the change happens and it kind of they figure it out, then people are in general happier with it. So that's kind of the way we're going.
So do we know why this 40% doesn't want to change? It's just easier that way? Is that it? Or
yeah, we don't know exactly why. I would assume that it's just because it is a change. You're going to have to change your daycare. You're going to maybe have to change some of your commute time or, you know, whatever. So I think that just the change.
Yeah. So the cost, Todd, is about $1 million more a year. And is that for new bus drivers, new buses, and then additional daycare before and after school?
Sure. So the cost that we were looking at was really to adjust our transportation schedules, because we'd have to bring in additional fleet and service the schools that way. The cost breaks out into two different parts, though. I know the consultant talked about $1 million as though it were a single number, but we actually buy our buses out of our capital budget. So we'll manage that separately, and that's about $200,000 of that cost. So we're looking at an operational cost that will run us somewhere between $600,000 and $700,000, which will include hiring additional drivers, the fuel costs, and maintenance costs of additional buses in the fleet. So that it's manageable. It wasn't where we wanted to go originally when we were with the Start Times Committee, but it's making sense now as we have information from the survey.
So is it just a one-time cost then of $200,000 for the new buses that would be needed?
So that would be like $200,000 over time. So if we pull 8 buses into the fleet, that's about $120,000, $150,000 a bus. So that's the total price tag of bringing the fleet up to snuff.
Okay, and would we need then to supplement the before and after school care to do this?
So, yeah, we ran some studies. The question with going to two bells is how much will that time be needed? So we're still working through some of those details. The two bell time doesn't start as early in the morning and doesn't go as late into the afternoon. So we'll need to really flesh that out and find out exactly what that looks like.
But part of it is the parents like need to get to work, and so
sure.
Now where do their kids go?
Sure. But again, looking at the two bells, the options there aren't as far apart as the three bell that were in the survey.
Now, the survey didn't even have an option for a two-bill schedule. It was just really the choice of the three options or to do nothing. So do we need another survey now to tell to find out what people think about a two-bell schedule?
I think some of the information we have from the three-bell will carry over into looking at the logistics for a two-bell. So we're still looking at the high school starting at 8:30 in the morning. And the modeling that we had at that, we were having to split our elementary schools across two different start times. And so taking that into account, we have the feedback that many of the elementary parents didn't like the three-bell options. So if we're able to mitigate those issues that they brought out under the three-bell, I think it will translate over into a two-bell solution.
Pretty much we know that everybody wants to start between 8:15 and 8:30. Everyone that we survey, that's pretty much the result that we get of, that would be great if I could be 8:15 to 8:30.
So. Well, and that was certainly the concern that was brought up during the board meeting, is that if we do let our kids sleep in. We're missing the objective here by putting them on the road at peak traffic times. And so I know that the decision to go to a two-bell is contingent on working with Park City to figure out that traffic solution. But is the test period then this winter where we see a bus coming in from Camas? I mean, are we going to know that that's then going to work for this? I mean, before we go to the expense and just the scheduling chaos.
Sure. We have some lead time now that we know that the idea is to look at a two-bell system seriously. We can now work more closely with the city and the county with very specific details to say, this is the volume that we can anticipate. Here's the exact timelines this will happen. What solutions are available to address that? Is changing the 248 corridor something that we really need to get behind and push? Or are there some other mitigation things that we can do with regards to how the students come to the high school on Kearns? Do we change transportation patterns that way? Do we close off the parking and have satellite parking and shuttling in and things like that? So we can really dig in and come up with some ideas over this time period before we have to make some capital outlay.
All right. And go through with the scheduling
changes.
Yeah. So with my understanding, a third of the kids already taking parent release for a later start time, perhaps there's a way just to offer that to more kids, maybe offering core classes later in the day. I mean, it sounds to me we could do that for a lot less than $1 million a year.
Well, we already offer that. I mean, the kids can take either miss first period, so be a later start, or they can miss even third or fourth period, so they're out earlier. That is something that is done, you know, with a parental permission and with a request. But the reason that, at least for me, that that's not the solution for our district is because that limits that option, or that option is limited to people who have other transportation. Either their parents can bring them in, or they are driving themselves. So we would – later start times are good for – every student, as far as an adolescent student, and so we need to be able to provide that option to everyone, no matter what your socioeconomic situation is.
Okay. So what did you figure, 8 buses that we're going to need to make this happen?
Something in that range. We'll now sit down with the consultant and finish out the implementation. Now that we know what the option is, we can really get serious.
All right. Let's turn to the budget. Preliminary budget discussions focused on the addition of 25 new full-time employees that will be added over the summer. Julie, you've been pretty vocal about your concerns, that being that we really don't maybe need this many people, and that could also compromise the productivity of our existing educators and staff. So can we do this?
I have questioned and asked about the positions multiple times. And Dr. Connolly seems very confident in being able to handle, you know, the influx of the additional staff and the training. We're just going to have to, I guess, wait and see how that actually shakes out, and if we can actually fill that many positions between now and the next school year. I think she just really wants to have it included in the budget, so as she is able to fill those positions, she has authorization to hire them. So I think that's kind of where we, Todd.
And we've heard these concerns all along the way. These positions aren't suddenly popping out today. We've talked about them for several months. And so the concern about being able to onboard and will we be able to bring them into the schools in a timely fashion and in an appropriate way have all been taken into account. In fact, when we put the superintendent's proposal together, we actually have it spread out over 3 years. So we're talking, this is the first implementation of staffing to address the mental wellness of our students and being able to support them appropriately. And then we have some second year and third year recommendations. Obviously, they don't fall into this budget because the board can only adopt an annual budget and not a multi-year budget. But we've contemplated, we've taken into account the concerns that we're doing too much all at once, and we've spread it out over 3 years. So we're conscious of that and trying to do the right thing.
Break it down for me then for this coming school school year, how many of those 25 positions are for new teachers?
So about, I think there's a total of 11 positions that will be new teachers. If you want to talk like classroom teachers, we have additional teaching type staff coming in to help with special education and with interventions. So they are technically teachers, if you will. They'll be on the teacher's contract, working directly with the students, but in those specialty areas, supporting the students' success in the classroom.
So what are those? I mean, are they about staffed at one school then, those positions, or do they district-wide?
Sure. It's a mix of everything. So we're looking at the specific student needs within each of the schools and directing those staff into the schools where those students are. And then there will also be positions that oversee the general situation of the school district as well. So it'll be a mix of in the schools directly and supervising generally.
So what are these people going to do? I mean, give me an idea. The special ed people would work with special needs students to do what?
To help them be successful in the classroom. Essentially, we have students with severe disabilities that need some special one-on-one attention. And having a classroom teacher try to address that just by themselves and take care of the other children in the classroom isn't the best situation. So these teachers will be working directly with those students, helping them access the curriculum, be successful in the work that they're doing, address IEP plans that are in place for those students. So there'll be some direct work right with the students.
And then the folks that are doing the intervention work, where are they going to be? In the counseling offices? Are we just beefing up the counseling?
No, again, these are working directly with the students and with the teachers working with the students. So if they're spending time in the district office, we're not deploying them very well. They need to be out and about and working directly with what's happening in the classroom.
So they'll be in the classroom with the teacher and just on a rotating basis?
So I'm not an expert on everything that's intervention. I'll have to defer some of that to Kathy Einhorn and the superintendent. But as I understand it, they will not be in the district office, but will be working in the classrooms with teachers and kids.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering. I mean, are kids then pulled out? And it's like, oh that's a kid with the problem because, look, they're going with that teacher.
That's not the model that we're looking at.
No, we have a push-in model. It's our standard kind of model that we try to use because it is – studies have shown that if kids are left in the classroom and exposed to the regular everyday instruction, they do much better.
Let's talk about how we're going to pay for all of this. We know that, with the teacher's salary increase and then the 25 new employees, we're talking about pulling $6 million from the Rainy Day Fund in addition to the $1.4 million or something that we got from
Correct.
New Growth and the WPU funding. So to do this for next year, it works, but we have to sustain that. So how does that happen in future years? Because you won't have that rainy day fund to pull from.
Sure. We have several revenue streams that we build the budget around. So we have the state support through the weighted pupil unit. So in our forecasting, we're expecting somewhere in the range of 2% increase in the value of the WPU, which will then take into account those future years. We're also looking at property tax growth. We've been experiencing about, on average, 1.4% in new growth revenue from properties being developed within our boundaries. So that's built into the scenario as well. Those two alone are not enough, and so we will be looking at tax considerations. And so we've put a model together that was presented yesterday where in year two, so 2 years out, there would be a tax increase. The impact on a home of $650,000 is about $86. It's important to note that this year the board is not contemplating a tax increase, which has the effect of allowing the certified tax rate to drop, saving a taxpayer $71 on average. So if you take those 2 years and net them against each other, it's – in 2 years, it's a, $10-ish, $15-type increase. The third year also is in consideration, and there would be a tax increase in that year of about $86. And so when you take that into account, there is a tax increase. But if we look at last year and this year's reductions, last year was about an $86 decrease. And so in 3 years out, if it's an $86 increase, it's kind of washing out over a four-year cycle.
For teacher salaries and
such. And additional, correct.
Yeah. In addition, though, we're talking about passing a bond is what the hope is here, and that would also add another 115 or something.
Depending on what that bonding amount is, we've done a survey into the community to find out where the pressure points are and what are the projects that the community is willing to get behind. So there'll be some discussions about that at a future board meeting.
Again, how long does that tax increase then for salaries and M&O then last?
So that's a permanent adjustment, just like the reductions are a permanent reduction.
Yeah, but I mean, it'll sustain for so many years, then we see the expenditures, you know, again overtaking the revenues. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So there's always the annual discussion of looking at the budget. There are pressures each year that need to be addressed. So we're kind of doing a pro forma, if you will. We're looking at today with today's decisions, and we're using a 5-year time horizon to say, okay, what all needs to come into play in the next 5 years, as best as we can see, and budget accordingly so that we're responsible in what we're doing with the taxpayer dollar.
So worst case scenario, what happens if we see assessed valuation drop, the economic downturn, legislature not contributing?
Sure. So we do have a rainy day fund balance above and beyond what we're talking about deploying now. So that's in this scenario, it will be about $10 million. So we have cushion to deal with those downturns and unexpected events as we move forward. That's a pretty healthy balance.
The classified contract, my understanding, was also ratified. Usually this follows what teachers get. So did they all see a $7,000 salary increase?
So for the classified employees, I don't know that a $7,000 makes the same sense as much as we looked at a COLA increase for each of the next 3 years. So a 4% COLA each year for 3 years, you know, compounds to a little over 12% over the life of this contract. So it's healthy, but it's the board's expression of appreciation of the work that the classified employees do and recognizing that they're valuable and very critical to what's happening in the district. So they wanted to recognize that.
Okay. What does that mean in terms of dollars, though? I mean, of a dollar increase?
So that's hard to pull out on average because we have classified employees that work in different job descriptions, and so their pay is different. So it's easier to speak in terms of a percentage increase that then translates through to each of those job titles.
Okay, I'm just, what does it add to the expenditures?
The bottom line, mm-hmm. Over the 3 years, it's a little over $1 million.
Okay.
And we also are opening up the insurance options for any employee that works 30 hours or more.
So that could add increases as well?
Yeah, so that increases the overall compensation package. So that's not take-home pay, if you will, but that provides an opportunity to participate in the health programs that the district offers.
Okay, and then Julie, tomorrow you've got three candidates you're interviewing for Phil Kaplan's seat, District 1, on the school board. Is that going to be one of the questions that you ask? Is like, you know, are you willing to increase taxes? Because that's what it sounds like a board member is going to have to do.
Well, you know me, Leslie, and yes, I will be asking about, you know, budget and or taxes. So what we have done is we've got a list of about 20 questions, and each board member is just kind of marking, I'd like to make sure we ask that. And JJ is compiling those. So she hasn't got the final yet, but those, I believe she provided the questions to the candidates yesterday.
Okay. And then you'll have an announcement, you believe, next Tuesday.
Yes. We're going to interview on Thursday from 1 to 3 is what we have scheduled. And then we will announce Tuesday at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. Julie, Todd, okay. Thanks for coming in.
Great. Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:35. Good morning. Well, the Park City Council will take up the issue of senior housing as well as water project and rates at its meeting tomorrow. In the studio with a preview, City Manager Diane Foster along with Public Utilities Director Clint McAfee. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So the study session on senior needs and senior housing starts at 3:45. Diane, staff asking council to discuss the need for expanded senior housing and services. I guess what jumped out to me in the report is, oh my God, we're getting old. From 1990 to today, we've seen the numbers jump from, 148, 65 years and older, to more than 890. So we just have a growing senior population?
We do, and we're all going to continue to get older. That is what we absolutely know.
There was some analysis done that seems to say, though, that the market is saturated. There really is no more needed in terms of assisted living and or nursing home. So what are we talking about here?
You know, it's an interesting challenge, and this study was done a few years ago for this area. And it's one of the things that we find is that as people age, they don't want to live in the snow, and so they tend to move out. So while the need might, you know, there might not be the demand within city limits, there is and there have been some facilities built in Oakley as well as in Snyderville Basin, although some of those facilities and in Heber City. In fact, last night there was an amazing joint meeting, and one of the things that was talked about was how much senior housing is being built in the Heber Valley. And if you think about snow, it's a little better down there.
So is that what the city's talking about, though, that we need to have some more senior housing here?
So it's interesting. This item wasn't brought by staff. This item was brought by members of the community who contacted the mayor as well as several city council members and requested this. So this is an on-request one, where we'll be discussing housing as well as other senior needs.
So have we identified any locations for something like this?
In the city, we haven't. You know, we've got, I think one of the questions for council is, how do you want to designate some of the affordable housing for seniors? You know, we did that in the Snow Creek project, and we only had one of the units that's occupied by a senior. There was another senior that was successful in the lottery but decided not to move in. And there are sometimes some things we do differently. One of them is considered called universal design, which is has some of the ADA elements in them and is generally, as you're aging in place, is a little bit better. And so we're talking to council about that, and it's a need that's going to exist, and it's just a question of how much of a need, and do you want to build units that anybody can apply to, including seniors, or do you want to specify ones for seniors?
Yeah, so when we talk about affordable housing, is senior housing then part of the 800 units?
It absolutely is part of the 800 units. One of the big challenges, though, is there are a number of folks in town who've been quite fortunate. You know, they might have bought their home for $100,000 or less, and now it's worth over $1 million. And they want to sell it and downsize. The problem is they don't qualify for affordable housing. And so that's one of the challenges we're faced with as well.
Yeah. So back to locations, there was some talk a while back about perhaps looking at the North 40. Is that even in the works here?
There's nothing on the city docket right now that we're looking at anything in the North 40.
But that's school district property anyway, isn't it? Or is it city-owned?
Ooh, I think part of it's city owned,
yeah.
And we're not targeting anything there. I think about 2 years ago there was some discussion about is that something that council wanted to explore, and we haven't gotten any direction on that.
Okay. In addition to housing, I think you're also talking senior programming. Many have said that they're interested in participating in organized activities outside the senior center. So was that part of all of this discussion?
It is part of all this discussion. The reason is that, and what we found with discussion on teens, we found that there's actually a lot of programming that happens, but folks might not know about it. So one of the intentions of this study session is just to educate about what is available. And then the other piece is to provide a forum where city council can talk about what other services they want to discuss having. One of the possibilities as we build the new community center, which will be a combination of the senior center and rec center, and that'll be next to City Park, and that's in the process of being designed and built, is do we want to go from 2 days a week programming to more days a week programming? And we do that in conjunction with the county, and it's a successful program, although it's not a five-day a week program now.
Also this week, Jason Glidden named as the new housing development manager. Now, is this a new position or is it just a renaming of his existing job?
This is exciting. When we look at the city council's 800-unit goal, one of the things that we're getting right now is we've got good momentum, right? We've got projects that are under construction and we've got projects in the pipeline. And what we did as staff was we all sat down and said, how are we going to staff these? And we realized that we didn't have enough people to get it done. So we proposed it in the budget, so council hasn't technically approved it yet. And if council doesn't approve it in the budget, Jason will remain in his current position. So we've started to advertise for his position, but we won't be actually hiring a new special events person until after the budget closes. Jason has a lot of skills, both from a business experience as well as great relationships inside the city. And why that matters is that there's a lot of internal processes that we have to go through as well as external ones. So
So how is this different than from what Rhoda Stauffer's doing? She's your housing specialist.
Right. Rhoda does a ton of work, and what we realized was that just to do 800 units in 10 years, the workload is too much. And Community Development Director Anne Laurent, she's going to be shifting some of the tasks that she's been doing to Jason, as well as with what we see, with what we've got in the pipeline, we're seeing a significant increase in workload.
Okay, and let's see, you heard yesterday at this joint meeting, basically you were asked what would you have done if you could 20 years ago? And the answer was an earlier start on dealing with affordable housing. I guess that led to a lot of discussion about that. So it sounds like, what have we been doing the last 20 years then? Thinking about it?
So last night was a joint meeting of the four councils, and those four were Summit County, Wasatch County, Heber City, and Park City. If you had told me we were going to have an affordable housing conversation with those four entities, I would have told you you're crazy. And we also talked transportation. Those were the two big topics. And it was a great question. Heber City Police Chief Dave Booth facilitated a discussion about what would you do differently. And it's just that idea, when you get to look back, you get to learn things. So, for example, Councilmember Tim Henney talked about the fact that when we went to Aspen, we learned a lot of things that are 20 years in our future, because they started a lot earlier than we did on our program. The big things we heard were about making sure you land bank if you can't get a head start on it. Make sure that you get into the game, not just the developers. Pay attention to deed restrictions and items like that. And also the four councils agreed that they wanted to get back together. And Heber City Manager Mike Davis actually proposed a kind of non-binding regional planning process.
I want to continue on this housing note, because also on the agenda is an agreement for the Marsac 100 part. It's a 2-acre parcel owned by Redis, the same owner as Bonanza Flat, being sold at a sheriff's sale, I guess, next month. It has mine tailings on it. The city's interested in acquiring the property. And in exchange, Redis would be relieved of building 5 affordable housing units that it's supposed to build. So why does the city want some contaminated property?
We want to build affordable housing on this, end of story. And we think it'll happen where Redis is basically, they deal with foreclosed properties. They're a real estate company. We think it'll happen faster if the city takes ownership of the property, and that's one of our big goals. And one of the things we did highlight in the meeting is that our number one biggest challenge as a city with building 800 units is simply availability of land.
So when you talk about spending $1 million just for possible tailings removal, how does this become affordable housing? That's just cleaning up the property before you put a foundation in.
No, that's true. And that's what Habitat for Humanity built 2 homes up by there, we don't expect it to be $1 million cleanup.
My understanding is that this was the site of the old mill area, no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's true.
So a little bit different situation.
No, this whole area is, where the Marsac building is was the Marsac mill, and where 100 Marsac is was also a mill site. So they're not significantly different. And what we've found and what the EPA has found in those areas is that when you test the soils, you have one part that's really contaminated, and then next to it, it's not.
Okay, so that's 2 acres. How many units could you build?
I don't know.
I'm just wondering if it sounds like maybe 6 if they're third of an acre parcels, but are we talking maybe multifamily?
We haven't proposed it at this point. This is one where a piece of land came available. We know we're land short, and so we jumped on it.
Okay, and there's also the possible acquisition of the Mine Bench property. This is where the former mine ride was up there, up Marsac Avenue to the right there, mm-hmm. across really from that connector road. So what do you want this for?
This again is in that kind of land banking. We saw an opportunity. We saw a piece of land. It could be affordable housing, although I think we're also saying, could it be public utilities? Could we store equipment up there as we are constrained on the Iron Horse site? So it's one of those. Land came available, we're going to grab it.
So we're not talking about housing there?
It's one of the things that City Council could consider. We don't have a specific, this is exactly what we're going to use it for yet.
Okay. This would forgive Redis then from having to build the gondola that was required by the Flagstaff annexation. So wouldn't that be more valuable to you?
I don't think anyone at this stage thinks the gondola from that particular site. You know, when we look at transportation, we really want gondola links to come into transportation areas, and that's not really – we don't want to send more traffic up there.
We should also note that the agreement lets them off the hook for having to build additional trails in the area, really rather replacing, I think, trails that were disrupted as a result of the development. So, but this is no cash. This is just trades for giving for, you know, again, the five affordable units, the gondola and the trails.
You know what? I'd have to go. We had about we've got a 10-hour meeting tomorrow. This is our fourth 10-hour in a row, and I actually don't remember the details of that report. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
Let's talk about Cliff and this, Clint. This is about the budget. I guess the, good news for council members and officers like you, Diane, including the attorney, the engineer, and the recorder, all getting a 2% pay raise. What about the rest of the staff?
The rest of the staff is actually eligible for that same 2% pay raise, and I say eligible because there are criteria. We're going through reviews right now, and if you don't meet your performance criteria, you don't get the 2%.
Big part of the budget, of course, is for capital projects, water projects, a number of them, upgrading the Quinns Water Treatment Plant, the construction of the Creekside Water Treatment Plant, the proposed Judge and Spiro Water Treatment Plans. There's a chart at Clint in the packet that shows Park City water rates are the most expensive in the state. Is that with or without any proposed tax or water rate increase?
Those are existing rates, so that is without the proposed rates, both for Park City and the comparables in the list.
Average monthly bill here, $150 a month. Summit Water, only $65 a month. Those living in Orem paying $25 a month. So how come we're paying so much more than everyone else?
Yeah, so the first thing to note about that comparable table is it's based on an annual average. And so what we looked at was a what a small family, like a family of four, would use on an indoor basis, as well as what they would use irrigating about a tenth of an acre of grass. And so Park City has rates that encourage conservation. And so the more water you use per month, the higher you pay on a unit basis. And so that $150 is really reflecting those higher charges for the higher consumption. And I did a quick calculation, and, you know, someone living in a condo or a small house that didn't irrigate and used 5,000 gallons a month, the monthly bill would be closer to $72 a month for Park City. And compare that, I live in Silver Springs on Mountain Regional. I think I pay about $65 a month for about the same amount of water. So it's tough to compare with all, you know, amounts of usage. But on the lower end, council generally has a policy that we try to keep those rates as low as possible and put the higher cost water on the higher consumers.
Yeah.
And so that table reflects that higher use.
But what we have seen, though, is that if people start using less water, then rates have to be increased because you're not getting the same amount of money because of people using a lot of water.
Yeah. That goes both ways, really. You know, we're at the top of the watershed here in the Weber River drainage. And while we do have surplus water available, we don't have enough water to fulfill demands if people didn't conserve. So, in other words, if people did not conserve, we'd be looking at a sharing a large import project with the regional partners like Mountain Regional and Summit Water. And so by conserving, yeah, we're bringing in less revenue, but we're also avoiding a large importation project. And then another thing to point out in that comparable, especially with the utilities along the Wasatch Front, they're really different models. Like I said, we're at the top of the drainage. We don't really have any storage. And so we've been forced to pump water from Rockport Reservoir, develop more expensive sources, where along the Wasatch Front, you've got the benefit of large federal projects that were built decades ago at a very cheap rate and the economies of scale for people to pay for those projects.
So for the upcoming budget, are we talking an increase in water rates?
We are. Kind of break it down into three categories. There's a 6% across the board rate increase. And council directed staff to look at the irrigation rates. So these are meters that just serve irrigation in the summertime. And their goal was to, or is to, eventually over time bring those, the cost of those irrigation meters up to what someone pays on a year-round basis for a residential meter. Because currently we only charge during the summertime for those irrigation meters. So there's a 10% rate increase on those irrigation meters plus the 6%. So it's a total of 16% on an irrigation meter. And again, those are just meters that serve irrigated, large irrigated spaces. And then we're also implementing the phased energy surcharge over the next few years. So I don't know the percentage there, but we're raising it enough to generate more money that can go towards energy efficiency and renewable projects.
So when are these rate increases going to end? I mean, it happens every year. 6% is huge.
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's a little unsettled at the moment. Right now, I'd say the long-term driver for these rate increases is the treatment of Judge and Spiro tunnels. I'd say over the last 10 years, we've been paying for water supply projects. Now we're kind of looking forward to water quality projects. And a large portion of the water quality projects are to treat water for stream water standards in addition to drinking water standards, which really adds the significant cost. And we are in active discussions with the State Division of Water Quality right now to try to balance the cost with the environmental benefit in the stream and mitigate some of those costs. So right now we're projecting, based on the worst case scenario, if we have to treat all of that water, but we're hopeful we can treat less or, you know, maybe get some different standards for our stream water discharge. So depending on the outcome of that, that's what's really driving the rates. But even under the best case scenario, we're still looking at 5-6% rate increases, at least for the next 5 years.
Wow. Okay. Clint, Diane, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:53. Good morning. Well, it's been a while, but the art party started back in the 1990s, being revived in the studio to tell us more about the return of Whose Art. I have founders Randy Barton and Bill Cranstor. Good morning, both of you.
Don't give us too much credit. We weren't the founders, but we were the, I guess we were the perpetuators.
Okay.
We were the cleanup crew when everybody kind of bailed.
Started in the 80s, actually, at the Wasatch Brew Pub, one of the first things upstairs.
89, yeah.
Yeah.
Scott Becker, Michael Begay, Allison Melville,
John Helton,
a number of other people.
Who's art? Who is art?
So exactly. What inspired you? We'll talk about that, but what inspired you to put it back onto the calendar here?
Well, getting old, and we hadn't done it, I don't think, for a decade. We figured 12 years, and
yeah.
We used to do it with some regularity, and as you age, I guess you lose your regularity.
Well, we lost.
Trying to bring back some regularity.
We lost the focus for a while, and thanks to Randy, you know, we actually tried to do it last year. For some reason, it didn't work out. It's all coordination, you know. Obviously, it's getting artists in and musicians, and it's a lot of work.
And the joke always is Cran says, we should do a Who's Art. Let's, you know, get this organized and let's do it. And I said, okay, so who's the we? Is this me again?
He always starts out, and then I generally run it to the 30-yard line, and I toss him the ball.
He takes the credit. I do the work. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this is going to happen at least once that we know of. It's a Saturday, 7 to 10 p.m. at the Park City Library. They're in the community room? Is that where it's happening?
It's going to be downstairs in the coffee shop and then all the way up top in the film series. Because we want people to run stairs. We think that's an art form in itself. We just stand at the bottom and watch them, obviously. But upstairs, Jill Urschel is orchestrating some films that will be in the Sandy from 7 to 8. And then they have the regular film at 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
But there will be art up there. We've learned that you move the bar where you want people to be. So the bar will be upstairs from 7 to 8. Then we'll move it downstairs into the coffee shop.
Okay. It's kind of like the kitchen where everybody wants to be.
So in addition to the films, what else have you got lined up?
Well, we don't line anything up. That's the point. It's a non-organized, non-affiliated, non-commercial, nonsensical gathering of artists, and it's an art party. Yeah. So there's no organization behind it, and we ask that people, artists out there, just show up and surprise us
and not
with
only
something
artists,
original.
But we left this out yesterday a little bit, but the general public, too. It's necessary that people show up and enjoy it. You don't have to be an artist or a musician or performance art or anything like that. You just show up and enjoy.
So you'll have a microphone?
We'll have a full PA so anybody can show up and play a song, recite a poem, do a little dance.
It's an open mic.
Yeah, and it's more than open mic because we ask that people bring something original. So it's not bring a track of Frank Sinatra and sing along. No.
That's the other
bring
requirement.
Bring something original.
It has
right?
to be original.
Original.
And is there an opportunity then for the visual arts as well?
Yes, and again, it's non-commercial, but it's an opportunity for artists, visual artists, to talk with other artists about their art and see what kind of direction they're going in and make some connections. So it's a gathering of people who want to get to know each other and who can share things.
Yeah. What have you heard? I mean, are you people excited about it?
Oh, yeah.
Back?
They'll bring, you know, we have not done it for a while. And so a lot of people have never been exposed to it. But it really is, I guess if you could capsulize it, it's just as local as you can be. And it is just fun. I mean, it's so amazing to see what someone can paint and a sculpture and a craft and a song.
And you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, you truly don't know what's going to show up.
Non-rehearsed.
Yeah. Well, I remember the one that stands out most for me was the one that Mary Beth Maziarz played at.
Yeah.
She had just moved to town and was just
knocked
phenomenal.
Everybody out.
Yeah.
And just showed up. Just like, all right, sit down and play. What do you got? Play us a song. Can you sing? You know the words?
And
again, wow, that was great.
It's a venue for people who don't have a venue, you know, or a gallery or a place to play or to recite poetry. It's open to those people who have paintings in the closet who don't show, and closet artists and poets.
And this has never had a home. We've always moved it. So this is the first time it's been in that building. We never did it in the old high school or, you know, the previous renditions. But I think what symbolizes whose art the most is our old friend Roger Fuller, just a wonderful man. And every time we would do a whose art, he would ratchet up his game and do something even more amazing.
His performance art was, pretty
incredible. Roller skated naked at one.
Yeah, how about the weather, huh? Isn't this great weather? Just that visualization.
All right, if you got some art, you want to perform, you want to show
a
it off?
Call to artists. Yep. It's an art party. The public show up. It's all ages. I would love for a 9-year-old to show up and recite something brand new or bring even a piece of refrigerator art that you drew for your mom.
Sure,
that's what
won't
we want.
Be there.
Anything original. Bring it.
Randy and Granny, thanks for your time.
Thanks.